This is Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 a.m.
You're with Reality Check Radio. It's Rodney Hyde, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Well, we've had some exciting and great guests, and you're going to love our next guest and the story that you're going to hear. It's a story that has never been properly told. And I think there's a reason for that, the reluctance of people that know the story to tell it, and also the treatment being meted out by the people who try and tell the story. The New Zealand news media have always just a sort of single narrative or a single way of looking at things. This is good, this is bad. And they don't see the nuance that is life. But we've got a very special man with us this morning. His name is James Harrison. He grew up in the Glorivale Christian community. He and his wife and children escaped. And he has agreed, really for the first time, to come on a news outlet and tell his story of his family, of his life, of Glorivale, and also to relate it to having escaped Glorivale, which some would describe as a cult, and finding himself back in it with the COVID tyranny. So it's going to be a very, very interesting discussion. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Rodney.
Now, you're James Harrison.
Yes, I was born James Harrison. And then my dad changed our surname to Ben Cain when I was about 10. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, we changed it back to Harrison, basically because I got sick of spelling Ben Cain out to every person that rung me on the phone. So...
Well,
that was
a
bit of a pragmatic reason.
I was going to have to ask you before we went on here how to pronounce Ben Cain. Tell me, what is the significance of Ben Cain for your dad?
Well, I think he said it was a sort of biblical name. It's derived from Hebrew. Ben means son of, and Canaan was the promised land in the Old Testament that the God promised the people of Israel. But he actually got the name out of a novel that he was reading to us children at the time. And the hero was Ari Ben Canaan. And so that was sort of his motivation, I guess.
Okay. Now, tell me, James, you've got an extraordinary tale to tell. Let's start at the beginning. What year were you born and where were you born?
So I was born in 74, January 74. I was born in the Rangiora Hospital, which I think is not far from where you grew up.
I was born in Oxford Hospital, but I grew up in Cust and Rangiora, yes.
Yeah. So, my dad went to the Rangiora High School. But my family was living at Cust at the time. And my dad owned the farm there at Cust. It was passed down from his dad. And my dad married the daughter of Neville Cooper at the time. He was an evangelist over from Australia. And he sort of settled in the Rangiora Cust area. My dad married his daughter, and my dad ended up giving his farm to the church to build the original community on at Cust there.
So George Harrison was your granddad.
That's right.
It was originally his farm, and Neville Cooper, as he was then known, the evangelist. He came over from Australia, what, in the 1960s, 67, thereabouts?
Yeah, it was late 60s, around 67, 68, somewhere around there.
Okay, and then the farm went from your grandfather, George, to your father, whose name was?
John.
John Harrison. Funny, yeah. George Harrison, John Harrison, sounds like the Beatles.
Yeah.
So, and then your Neville Cooper, what, started a church group which your father and grandfather became members of?
So, yeah, it started as a church, pretty much like any other church, really, yes, in those early days. And then it gradually grew into community. It wasn't until the late 80s that they actually started living in community. In the early days, it was just like a normal church, pretty much, and then it started... they saw on the scriptures about sharing and caring for one another, and so they sort of started sharing everything. Probably one of my favourite stories relating to that was my dad was given money to buy a new car when he was in his early 20s. It was after he was married. And there was some other poorer families in the church that didn't have cars. So instead of buying a new car, he went and bought two older cars, one for himself and one for another couple. And nice. The church did it up and gifted it to the other couple. So that sort of gives you an insight into what they were thinking back then and the sharing life that they were trying to establish. And it was really admirable. And I think it was an amazing thing that they were trying to do back in those early days.
Because it was very, what you'd call communitarian, wasn't it? It was like a true community. And tell me, so when you were born, you went to the farm that ultimately became the community, but at the time that you were born, the rest of the church members weren't living there.
No. When I was very young, I can remember meeting on Sundays in the St. John's Ambulance Hall in Ringura. Yes. That's where we had our Sunday meetings, and we were living on the farm. And then probably when I was about 10 years old, we started having meetings in camp, and they had built a school there by that time. And then in the early 80s, they built the first hostel accommodation unit, and people started moving onto the site, and then that sort of grew through the 80s. And then by the late 80s, it was like full community. All the meals were together. Everyone was wearing the same clothes. All the money was pooled, and it was, full-on community.
How many brothers and sisters do you have, John?
So I have 12.
I just called you John. James?
I've got 12 siblings. So my mum came from a family of 16 children, and then she had 13. And, we've got 15, so... it's in the blood.
Just go through those numbers again. Your mum came from a family of
16.
She had 13 children.
Yeah.
And you and your wife have had 15.
Yeah.
That's a lot of cousins.
It is, yeah. At one stage, a few years ago, my mum and dad had 96 grandchildren. That's going back 5 or 6 years ago. It would probably be well over 100 by now, I think.
And they're still alive?
No. My dad passed away, April last year.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. That's tough.
But, my mum's still alive.
Great. Now, so you grew up from the age of 10 and developing in a community which was largely closed to the outside world in the sense that you had your own schooling, church on site. The men would go out and work in the community, being tradespeople and the like. Obviously, services would come in. The women, they went out to go shopping and have babies?
Yeah, back in those early days, it was mainly my grandfather did most of the, I know he bought all the food. He would go to the markets in Christchurch and that and buy all the food.
Okay.
I'm not sure sort of about the other household stuff. I guess the ladies probably did that.
And your grandfathers, of course, you've got two in the community, both very strong. One, the evangelicist called Neville Cooper, later to become Hopeful Christian. And then your father,
my grandfather, George
Harrison. Okay, yeah. You're going to have to help me here. So you grew up in a very religious, Christian, closed community where ultimately the woman all wore the long dresses and had the bonnets on their heads. And what was you went to school in the community?
Yeah, all my schooling was in the community. Yep, right from the start to the end.
And what were you taught about life?
I guess probably in my schooling years, it was pretty much the same curriculum that a lot of other schools did. As time went on, they more focused the curriculum on training children to be good community children. They weren't wanting to train them to have a life outside the community. It was all focused on how they could better serve the community. But in my schooling years, I think I pretty much did what most other kids my age would have done.
So over time, it became increasingly insular.
Yeah.
Was it a happy childhood?
I had an amazing childhood. I don't think I could ask for a better childhood. It was just, living on the farm and friends and family around all the time. And we did amazing stuff, built tree huts down the hill and fought one another and did all the crazy stuff that boys back in those days used to do. And right through my teenage years, I had an amazing childhood. Couldn't ask for better.
Well, as you say, I grew up in Rangiora and I visited the community and I wondered about it. And when I say I visited, I worked there for several days doing a driveway with a group of men. And I thought it looked amazing. And in some parts of me envied your lifestyle because you were very self-sustained too, weren't you?
Yeah, there was always a focus on growing all our own food as much as possible. Obviously, there were some things that couldn't be grown, but huge vegetable garden.
And everyone working literally as a community. And the other thing was I have never seen in my life happier kids.
Yeah, that was me. I was one of those kids.
You would have been. Yeah, they were bouncing around their trampolines and it was joy, literally joyous. And I can remember at lunchtime, everyone singing and saying a prayer. And obviously to me, it also looked a bit isolating from the rest of the world and the outside world. And it also seemed to me to be a bit of a prison in the sense that everyone would at a very young age would get married and you think, well, I wonder how that goes. So who were the four? Obviously, Hopeful Christian Neville Cooper was a very, very powerful. He was, when you met him, he was a very, very powerful man.
Yeah.
It's hard to describe, isn't it?
It is. He was an amazing speaker.
Yes, I can remember that.
Amazing power. And then, yeah, if you got on the wrong side of him, yeah, he let you know. And, yeah, he had a way of putting down people that didn't agree with them.
Yes.
And that, in a way, that became a very bad thing because he lost all accountability because anyone who disagreed was just pushed aside.
Yes.
And they would end up leaving.
And he was your grandfather.
Yeah, he was my grandfather. Yeah.
And I'm just trying to think now, he was your wife's grandfather too?
No, he was so he's my mum's father.
Okay, that's right.
No relation to my wife. No.
Okay. And so by force of character and ability, he was the community in the sense that he said what would happen next and everyone would have to go along with it, and willingly so.
Yeah. They always had men's meetings to make the decisions and that, but that was basically hopeful getting all the men to see things his way.
Yes.
That's what the meeting was.
Well, he's incredibly persuasive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I heard him preach on the streets on a Friday night in Rangura, I'm going to say in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he was hypnotic.
Mm.
He would speak to a group, and I've never experienced anything like it before or since, where he could, you'd literally be walking past and he would be weaving a spell.
Yeah, I believe it. No, he was an amazing speaker.
Yeah, and it's until you've experienced it, it's quite hard for people to believe it, right? So he was, we've picked it up, we had a glitch, we've picked it up again. He was a very hypnotic speaker. So basically he was the father figure and wielded, for better or worse, a tyrannical control over the community.
It became a tyrannical control over time. His personality, and it was his way or the highway, basically.
Do you think he planned it that way, or do you just think that's the way it evolved, that he was a good man?
There are others that would disagree with me on this, but I feel that that's just the way it developed because of his personality, because he sort of shut other churches and that off over time and lost accountability.
Yes.
But I don't think he planned it that way.
Yes. So when you were growing up, what was your view of the outside world?
My view of the a pretty scary place. Very evil. There was everyone out there was pretty bad. It was just a pretty terrifying and scary place.
Because that's a clever thing to do in order to get further your tyrannical control, isn't it? Like it's a communist dictator thing. There's a scary world beyond our borders.
Yeah, and on top of that, all the other churches were false believers. They had a false gospel. We were the only true church. And so you couldn't leave Gloryvale or Springbank, as it then was, and be a Christian still. You would be lost and go to hell because you would be leaving the true church and going out, either going out and being a completely lost worldly person or going out, and if you joined another church, you were still lost because you had left the true church. So
you growing up only had friends from within the community.
Yes. Yeah.
And you had no opportunity like sport or schooling.
No.
To learn or meet anyone else.
No, we had neighbouring farmers that I would meet on the odd occasion. Never met children my age. I only ever met like the adults. I don't know if that was by design or that's just the way it happened. But the interactions with our neighbours were very brief, and you know, you might just say hello, say a few words, and that was it. But yeah, not really anything to do with them much.
And when I came there working, everyone was very pleasant to me.
Yeah.
But the only thing I do remember is my foreman coming to tell me, it was a very hot summer's day, and I was a young boy, and the foreman came along and said, "Mr. Cooper's asked you to put your shirt on because he doesn't want to give the girls the wrong idea." And it was quite funny because then my foreman says, "I don't know what he's talking about because half of them are pregnant." And which I thought was quite funny at the time. But tell me, your view of me as an outsider working away there, would you see me as scary or someone to be sorry for? How would you regard an outsider?
I'd probably scary in a way. We just would avoid you and not.
Yes.
You didn't have anything in common with us. You were a bad person. We were taught to be respectful.
Yes, very, very polite.
Yeah, but avoid getting into conversation or anything. You might draw us away from the community, I guess.
Did you have a curiosity about what went on beyond the fence?
Not really. I think, I don't remember really being that interested, to be honest. I mean, we had a pretty good life, and I don't think as a kid, I don't remember being that interested in what went on outside, actually.
Interesting. Your mum and dad, they were true believers too?
Yep.
So the expectation was for you would be to get a trade, was it? Or what was the expectation that you would do for work?
Sorry, you cut out a little bit there.
What was the expectation for you that you would do for work?
To do for work, I would just do whatever the leaders decided for the community. I was very, very keen on being a farmer.
Yes.
I was in my blood. And I remember in my last year of high school, I was terrified that when I left school, I wasn't going to be allowed to work on the farm. And I remember worrying about that a lot. And it got me quite depressed thinking that I might not be allowed to work on the farm. And it wasn't, a part of that was they would often say, if I was a good farmer, they would deliberately put me into a different type of work because it was good for me to put down my flesh and my own desires and do something that was hard for me. That might seem strange to you.
No,
but that's the way it was.
And by the way, when you slept, did you sleep in a dormitory type situation?
So back until I was about 12 years old, we lived in our own house. And then in the late 80s, as we moved into community, we had a hostel. And just trying to remember, there was my mum and dad had a room where they stayed with, say, the youngest two or three kids. And then there was a bedroom that my sisters lived in and a bedroom beside that that and my brothers lived in.
And when you had your meals, you didn't eat as a family but as a community.
Yeah, that's right. Once in the late 80s, once we started sort of living in community, then we had all communal meals as well. We sat, like there was rows of tables, and our family would sit together on one place on the table. That was our designated family area. But it was, 150 people there all eating together.
And how do you get on in a community living? Because presumably some people work harder and some people are a bit lazy and don't pull their weight. Was that a problem living in that community, that you'd say, Bob didn't do much to help with dinner?
It is a problem, but I guess as a Christian, there was always pressure put on the lazy ones to work harder and pull their weight. And us ones that worked hard, forgive me, but us ones that worked hard were taught to not look down on the others, but, be patient with them. And it was good for us to, put up with their weakness and,
Well, the listeners won't see you like I can see you, but I can tell you that you're looking at a very healthy man. He looks like he could still put on an all-black shirt and come out as a good lock or a prop, James. Now, I was asking about work. So what you would do in your job was not to be decided by you and your mum and dad, but by the community, by Neville Cooper.
Yeah, that's right.
So you were scared that I want to be a farmer, but I may not end up farming because Neville Cooper decides something else.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember the day I left school, my dad came to me and he said, now I've gone and had a talk to Hopeful. He was still Neville then, actually. I've gone and talked to Neville and I asked him if you could work on the farm, because my dad was the farm manager. And Hopeful said, yes, you can, but you're going to get involved in the dairy farm, whether you like it or lump it. That was my dad's exact words.
Wow.
And I hated dairy cows. I'd been involved with the sheep and I loved sheep farming and I hated the dairy cows. And I was like, I hate this. But I thought, that's what I've been told. So I'll get stuck in and I'll learn to love it. And within 6 months, I absolutely loved dairy farming. And that's what I've done ever since.
And how old were you when you left high school?
I was 15. So, like, we finished school at the end of December, December like usual. And I was 14 then, and I turned 15 at the end of January. So,
got it.
Yeah.
Now, your cohort, the boys that were your age and a bit older, a bit younger, what did they go off and do?
Trying to think. One of my classmates became an electrician.
Yeah.
He started training to become an electrician as soon as he left school. One of them became a deer farmer. He was running the deer farm with his brother. Another one was put in the engineering workshop, doing automotive engineering.
And that was all with community members. They didn't go and do an electrician with Bob down the road who wasn't part of the community.
Yeah, they were all all apprenticed to men within the community.
Got it.
If any outside training needed doing, they'll do as much as possible by correspondence. But then sometimes they had to go to block courses and stuff.
Yeah.
But as much as possible, it was within the community.
And what about the girls?
The girls went straight to, what do we call it, domestic duties. So they were rostered on cooking one day, cleaning another day, washing another day. And that there was no opportunity for them to do anything else,
okay,
even if they wanted to.
And did you have any money?
Yeah, we were given pocket money. When I was around 10 to maybe 15 years old, I remember getting pocket money every week. It was something like 10 cents for every year of your age.
Yeah.
Which in those days was actually reasonably significant. But that got stopped when I was in my early to mid-teens.
We're just cutting out a bit there, listeners. I do apologize, but it's so interesting. We'll keep at it. So James here is living on a dairy farm. What do we expect? The Labor government's been terrible to farmers with their internet connection.
Yep.
Tell me, James, when you started, you got the pocket money, when you started working as a dairy farmer, did you get paid?
No. I've never had any right from when I started working when I was 15 to all my working life, never had any money given to you as a wage. Like if you went to town or something and you would be given some money to spend if necessary. And when you came back from town, you had to give an account of the money you spent and what you spent it on.
Got it. And I don't mean to pry, but and go too personal, but this will be interesting and important. How was the expectation is that you'd marry with someone within the community?
Oh, absolutely. Without exception.
So dating isn't like how we would date on the outside. You'd understand that now. So how did you meet your wife and how did you get married?
Yeah, my story is probably very different to a typical Glorievale story, but my wife joined the community when she was 13.
Mm-hmm.
She came from a very broken home and she was sort of adopted into a family within the community.
She came at 13 on her own.
Yeah, sort of. No, I think her mum brought her there. And then after a while, Hope didn't want to leave. She was like, "Nah, this is where I'm staying," because she felt loved in the family in Glorievale and part of a loving family. And she was like, "No, I'm staying here."
Good.
But then, I don't know how much I want to say here. I'll just say we were probably a bit rebellious and maybe worked things out a bit for ourselves. But I'll tell you the way it's supposed to be. So I would say go to my dad or to Hopeful and say, "I want to get married." We would pray about it. And then I'd go back to him a couple of weeks later and he would say, "Well, I think it's so-and-so, go away and pray about it." And you would be like, "Yep, Hopeful, you're right. It is that person." And then there was a short courtship, probably 6 weeks, is pretty typical, and then you get married.
And you get married quite young.
Yeah, there has been guys that have got married at 16, and girls that young too. In more recent years, it has got older, but typically for most of my life there, probably the average age for the guys was 18, I guess, and girls probably more like 20.
Okay. So you don't need to go in any detail, but we can detect that there was a girl from the outside came in at 13, gets a bit older. There's a young strapping boy who are mutually attracted to each other, and they might have skipped a bit of the praying bit, and it became love ahead of hopeful's blessing. And probably by the time you got around to asking Hopeful about it, you were a very sure of things, and you're a bit rebellious, and so you got married. How old were you when you married?
So I was 19, and I pretty much just turned 20, and Hope was 17.
Nice. That's lovely. And you started having a family probably immediately.
Yep, pretty much.
And your expectation was that you would live your entire life in the community and die within the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
And your Christianity, your brand of Christianity, was it obviously your living arrangements and working arrangements and family arrangements weren't typical, but was the Christianity that you were following sort of standard, rough enough Christianity, or was it some oddities?
Definitely some oddities. And there's a document I've read written by a Christian group that sort of gives an outline of beliefs of different groups and stuff. And they, in this article, they went through Gloria Bell's beliefs, and they came to the conclusion that Gloria Bell has some beliefs that put it outside of Christian orthodoxy,
yes,
and therefore can't be. You could haggle over that.
You just cut out then, James. Just tell us that, put it outside orthodoxy, and said
that you couldn't call it Christian. Okay. A true sense of Christianity. That's debate.
What we might...
Obviously, the living in community thing is very unusual in Christian groups, and, not having any personal possessions and submitting yourself to the leadership and the way they do.
Yeah. So you got married, you've presumably had a child within a year.
Yep, within 9 months, pretty much.
Good for you. You do look like that, all black. You are I do remember this, remarkably healthy and athletic looking community. Very good. You lived on the best food, right?
So Neville, who became Hopeful Christian, was very interested in nutrition. He used to read books on healthy diet all the time, and he used to talk to the ladies in the kitchen about the food and everything and make sure the diet was going to be good. And compared to a typical diet out here, very healthy diet, a lot of vegetables, meat and vegetables. No fast food. Yeah, you might have like fast food once or twice a year at best.
Yeah. And you're baking bread and growing everything on site.
Yeah.
And it was wonderfully fresh produce.
Yeah.
And it was a traditional diet and probably not a lot of sugar.
No, very little sugar.
And did the men drink any alcohol?
No, that was an absolute no-no.
And right, no smoking?
No smoking, no.
And probably no drugs?
Definitely no drugs.
So it was a remarkable upbringing.
And anyone in the community who was a little bit overweight, hopeful, would hound them and nag them until they got into shape. So, yeah.
Wow, that's great. I could have done with a month there. or probably now a year.
A year.
Yeah. So tell me. And that's what I observed, James. You know, I looked at this community and I've never been happy with how it's been characterized in the media. It's like so much of life. You know, that Alexander Solzhenitsyn line that good and evil, it'd be so much easier if there were good people and there were evil people and we could divide them up. Yeah. And the media present the world like that. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn said it's much more complicated because the line between good and evil runs through our own hearts.
Yep.
And when I saw that community, there was so much to be impressed about and so much to admire. And I'll never, till the day I die, forget how, and it would have been you and your friends and brothers and sisters, how wonderfully, joyously happy and healthy they looked compared to every other kid you could see on the world outside.
Yeah. I guess what I would say on the media issue, the way the media has portrayed Gloryvale over the years, I think a factor in that is the fact that Gloryvale is Christian.
Yes.
And I think the media attacks Christianity.
Yes.
And they like a sensational story, obviously.
Yes. And a sex story.
A sex story, yep. Mm. And I'm not here to try and say everything at Gloryvale is rosy either.
Of course not.
Serious problems there. And what I've described in the early days of a wonderful, caring, sharing spirit, and that developed into living in community, that ended up becoming communism, yes, basically, where everything was shared out and you didn't give from your heart because you wanted to help somebody else. You never had anything to give. It was, yes, taken and everyone got exactly the same share. And so it just became a mechanical thing and it lost the heart of what it was set out to be.
Yes. And of course, as time went on, it became increasingly tyrannical and quite possibly arbitrary.
And yeah, and as it grew, try and keep it together, the leaders developed just more and more rules, more and more control. Mm. And if you don't mind, I'll just go back to the point you were making before about Christianity. So just to try and put it as briefly as I can, so I think that any of your listeners that are Christian will probably understand what I'm saying here, but so we would describe Gloryvale as being very legalistic. So the biblical way of salvation, according to the Bible, is we're all sinners, we all fail, we break God's law, and paid our sin penalty, and when we put our trust in Christ, our sin is forgiven and our sin is put on Christ. Gloryvale has become a very legalistic belief system where you work and you earn your way to heaven, basically. The better person you are, the more chance you've got at going to heaven. And so then that develops into the leaders make a whole lot of rules to, you know, to keep people safe, to keep them within the boundaries, to help them get to heaven. And so they've missed the whole point of the gospel, where it's Christ that saves us, and they've made the community the saviour. And if you obey all the rules, if you do what the leaders tell you to do, if you submit yourself, all that secures your salvation.
That's a very, very insightful comment, and it allows me, and I'm assuming our listeners, to much better understand it. And I look at and often think about churches being creations of men, not Jesus and God.
Well, there are some that are, I would have to say.
Okay.
Yeah, ideally.
You're just cutting out again, James. It's so killing me because I'm blaming Jacinda Ardern. Tell me, what church do you attend now, James?
So we attend a Baptist church in Timaru.
And you chose a Baptist church because it was a good community, because it followed theological principles that you agreed to with. What brought you to a Baptist church?
Yeah, so I guess there's a number of factors there. The fact that it's Timaru, that's sort of a separate issue. But when it's a what most people would call a very conservative church.
Yes.
And for people that have just come out of Glory Vale, which is super conservative, yes, there's obviously an attraction there. But it was a church that my wife and I believed their sole focus was on preaching the scripture and following what the word of God says. So that was what attracted us there. The fact that it's Timaru is because I had a nephew and another friend that had left Glory Vale about 2 years before that. They were both young men that had worked for me on the farm at Glory Vale, and they ended up down here, and okay, I was able to keep in contact with them, and so it was sort of a logical place to come, I guess.
Okay. So you started having children.
Yep.
And didn't stop. I love that. Look, man, I love kids so much that I envy you with 15 kids. I truly, truly do. There are times when they infuriate you and you're overworked and that. And but they give, there's nothing like kids to bring such joy. My 34-year-old visited, and he brings me such joy. He's got a little boy, and he lives in the United States, and he visited. And nothing else of your life that you've achieved matters than to see these wonderful kids growing up and going through all the trials and tribulations of life and making mistakes and getting it right. And it's just the most joyous thing. I think you've done wonderfully, you and your wife. But moving along, something happened, or over time, you decided to leave this community that you had known nothing else. Your wife had come from tough circumstances and fallen in love with the community and had grown up in the community. And outside is this world that you've been warned of ever since you can remember. And you took, I'm going to ask you how many kids you had and what year it was, but you decided to leave. That must have been extraordinary.
Yeah, I would say it's the hardest thing by far that I've ever done in my life. And hopefully it's the hardest thing I'll ever do.
Yes.
But no, so we had 12 children when we left. My wife was pregnant with our 13th. And that was in March 2015. It came about over a period of probably a couple of years. I started to have serious questions about some of the doctrines that were being taught at Gloryvale. And I had access to some teaching from preachers in America, which was a banned substance. That was, another of the list of banned substances at Gloryvale was alternative teaching. And I could see that this teaching I was listening to was more biblical than what I was getting taught at Gloryvale. And I started to ask questions, speak up a little bit too much, and I got myself in a bit of trouble. And there was a friend of mine around the same time was sort of going through a similar thing, but he was a bit bolder than me and spoke out a lot more. And he ended up getting separated from his wife. His wife wanted to go with him at one stage, but she was talked out of it by the leaders and he was sent away by himself. And so we
he was excommunicated from the community.
Yes, yeah. And it had happened. He wasn't the first one that that had happened to. There was others before that too that were excommunicated. And there seemed to be a bit of a habit, and it's happened since then as well, that they'd excommunicate the husband and they would talk the wife into staying. And I think women being a bit more emotionally motivated, it's probably easier to talk them around. And they had a doctrine of if the children left the community, they would go to hell. But if the wife stayed there, her faith would save the children, even though the children were outside in the world.
Wow.
It's not a biblical doctrine.
Of course. So
that was taught very strongly.
So this friend that was excommunicated, he went with his children?
No, his wife and his oldest son had left, but the rest of the children and the wife stayed there.
And so he didn't have a choice to leave. He was kicked out.
Well, they sort of give you a choice. The choice, it's like the choice of taking the shot or not.
Okay, yeah.
I call it a choice if you want to, but it's not much a choice. You know, I've got to deny what I believe, deny my conscience, never speak out again, just submit myself, keep my head down. And, you know, anyone with any integrity can't do that.
He just left and left his wife and, apart from his oldest son, his children behind.
Yeah, I'm not 100% clear on whether he was told he had to leave or okay. You know, how much the difference is. But
come back to your situation, what you do know. So you were having these questions. You were starting to speak out. Was your wife on board with your speaking out in position?
She was very scared. She said to me a number of times, "Well, you know, you're going to get yourself in trouble. You need to just, you know, keep quiet, keep your head down, just keep it to yourself." Good reason. And the reason I told the story of my friend is because that affected the way we decided to leave the community in the end. We did it very secretively because we didn't want the leaders to have the opportunity to try and talk my wife out of it. We wanted to keep our family together. We had two daughters that were in their late teens, and one of them was quite soft-hearted and probably could have easily been talked out of leaving. And so we discussed it, my wife and I and our older kids, and decided that we weren't going to let anyone know and we would just escape, sneak out, literally in the middle of the night.
Wow. Tell me about the night you left. How did you do it?
So just I'll backtrack a little bit.
Please.
In 2011,
oh, you're just cracking up a bit.
Kilometers away.
Can I get you to turn your video off, James? And it might just improve the audio.
Yeah.
We blame the Labor government for shocking infrastructure services up and down this great country and how they've ignored and mistreated our farming folk to make us downtrodden and dependent. James, that'll be better. Take us back a bit. Yeah, yeah. It's fantastic.
So, going back to 2011, the community bought another property about 20 kilometres away from Gloryvale with the intention of building another community there in the future. It was a dairy farm, and I was put there as the manager. I'll tell a little story, which you'll probably find interesting. On the morning when we took possession of the property, which was 1st of June 2011, myself and three other younger guys that were going to be working for me, we were called into a room with one of the leaders, and he said to us, "Now, you're going to be going out there away from the community, running that property, and the neighbour there, we've got to be very careful of her. She has said openly that if anyone tries to leave Gloryvale, she will help them. So she's our enemy, so we need to be very careful of her." When I look back at that now, I'm just like, wow, that is just nuts. But that was just sort of the way they thought, you know, anyone who would help someone leave, wow, they were just like, they were doing Satan's work. And so I was running that property, that dairy farm, and I would live there quite often with my family. Sometimes on weekends we would go and stay in the house there. And so when we decided to leave the community in March 2015, it didn't look odd that we were staying out there for the weekend.
Got it.
And so we had taken all the clothing and some blankets and stuff, and we organised for a guy from the church in Timaru here came up with a rental van, drove up and picked up my wife and the younger children at about 7 o'clock. This was a Saturday night. And myself and the three older children went back into the community, and I had written a letter to the whole community explaining our reasons for leaving. And I did that because what happens, the leaders tell the story, and normally, I mean, they'll just spin it any way they want to. They'll say, oh, they left for this reason or that reason, and because they don't want people to know the truth. So we wrote this letter, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, we went around every bedroom and slipped a copy of the letter.
Oh, my goodness.
On the door of every bedroom. And then we drove out. Drove down to the gate. The night watchman looked in the car, saw who it was, waved us through, because they have a night watchman on the gate every night to stop anyone coming in, I guess. And then we drove down to Timaru.
Just help me here, James. How were you able to communicate with someone from Timaru in the church?
So because I was working on that farm, managing that farm, I was allowed to have a cell phone.
Okay.
And mainly for business purposes, like I'd ring, you know, farming companies and stuff to order stuff, and also that was the only way I could contact the community as well, was with a cell phone out there. And so I used the cell phone for I was very scared that they were going to look through the contacts and see who I had been ringing and stuff. So I would delete my my call.
And how did you have a sense that you could? How did you have a sense that you could trust this outsider?
Well, this outsider was my nephew.
Even so.
Oh, I guess for a start, I didn't trust him. For a start, my main contacting him was trying to convince him to come back to the community.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, he made me think hard about stuff. He would put tough thoughts in my mind that would make me think and realise that actually, I was being told quite a lot of lies by the leaders at Gloryvale. And there was a lot of stuff being said about this church down at Timaru that just wasn't true. And also, I guess we would have been very fearful of leaving Gloryvale because, honestly, at that stage, I probably still did believe that they were the only real true church. In New Zealand, anyway, I did know of churches in America that I believed to be good churches, but I thought, nah, New Zealand, they're a pretty wicked country. There won't be any decent churches in New Zealand. And then from talking to him, I thought, okay, this church in Timaru sounds pretty good. So,
so this was, I think you said March 2015?
I missed that question. It cut out again.
Was that March 2015 that you left?
Yes. Yep.
How old were you?
I would have been 40. 40. Oh, no, 42.
42. Yeah, 42. Just for our listeners that are tuned in, because we forget, because James and I have been here since the beginning, but you're listening to Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We're having a fascinating discussion with James Harrison, who grew up in the Gloryvale community and escaped with his wife with 12 children and one on the way. And he's telling us the extraordinary story of his life and of life growing up in Gloryvale, the good and the bad. And we've just got up to him and his wife escaping out into the world and heading with his escapee nephew, who's established in Timaru at the Baptist Church, and heading out into what your whole life you've been told is evil.
Yep.
Were you scared?
Very, very scared. And my wife was more scared than I was.
And how old was your youngest child?
So our youngest boy was nearly two at that time.
My goodness.
Yeah.
So what happened then, James?
So we left, as I said, in the middle of the night, literally. Now, this isn't to say that Gloryvale wouldn't have given us some money to help us out if we had have, you know, done it what they would call the right way, you know, gone talk to the leaders and told them we were leaving. But we knew of two smaller families that had left a year or so before us, one of them being my nephew, and they had...
Oh, dear.
...were family.
You just cracked up. Your nephew left, and what did he take? What did he get?
So they get... They gave him $1,000, and he had a wife and three children at the time. Okay. And so I thought, well, you know, if we do it the right way and, you know, ask for their blessing, they might give us $2,000 because we're a big family. But we thought the risk, you know, what's $2,000 at the risk of having your family split up? So we thought, well, we'll just took some clothes and some blankets and a few, you know, personal mementos, I guess.
So you are 42 with, it's hard for me to keep up, 12 children and a 13th on the way, youngest two, yep, with the clothes that you stand up in.
Yep. The crazy thing was, we came down to Timaru, that was sort of midnight Saturday night, and a couple in Timaru offered us their house to live in, and they put up a tent on the lawn. Still cracks me up a bit talking about it.
Okay, take your time.
They put up a tent on the lawn and lived in the tent for 6 weeks while we savaged their house, I guess, with our 12 children.
That is a story and a half, isn't it? I can't get
my head around it still.
And they were complete strangers to you?
Complete strangers, yep.
And they were members of the Baptist Church?
Yes, yep.
And what a wonderful, wonderful Christian thing.
They're still some of our best friends.
I bet they are. That cracks me up. It's just so heartfelt, beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And the really stunning thing for us was we'd been told all our lives that, you know, the so-called Christians out in the world, they don't love one another, they don't share anything. And, you know, we came down here and we were just blown away. We'd never been loved like we were loved then. And still, yeah, it just amazes me.
You're bringing tears to my eyes with the thought of, I think of myself as a kind person. But to open my house up to escapees with 12 kids and a pregnant woman to live on a tent, that's truly wonderful.
Rodney, I just add to that, our family isn't, I don't want to make it sound too bad, but our family can be a bit wild.
I bet.
And so, yeah, it's not like 12 children that are, you know, prim and proper and always neat and tidy and everything. They're they're pretty wild, barefoot bunch at times. So,
and of course, your older kids would be looking after the younger kids and raising them, helping your wife, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So you stayed there, and what was running through you and your wife's head?
We were having serious, we were blown away by the love of it all and the love that we're showing. And it was like an amazing adventure. But the mental stress was through the roof. It was like, have I done the right thing to my family? Are we going to? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, James.
Oh, sorry, it cut out again. I lost you. I've never been in such a bad mental state in my life. And, just the worry of, have we done the right thing by our kids?
Explain what worried you. Was it the whole world? Was it how you're going to provide for your children?
Yep.
Was it the loss of family or community? Was it all of the above?
All of the above.
Everything would be compounding on you, wouldn't it? Everything.
Yeah. I had a huge amount of family in Gloryvale. I had a very close relationship with my dad. And we knew when we left that that was all going to end, that we would be cut off. There would be no communication allowed. We would be treated as enemies, and that is exactly what happened. So obviously that causes a huge amount of stress.
And do you break your mum and dad's heart?
Yeah, I knew I was breaking their heart And that hurt to know that I was doing that, but it was the choice that, to us, it was the only choice we could make. So it was incredibly difficult.
And your brothers and sisters?
My brothers and sisters, I wasn't worried so much about them as I was about my parents, to be honest. Yes. But again, some of my brothers and sisters I was very close to, others not so much. You know, just, I guess, a normal family dynamic. But, the ones that I was close to, you know, it really hurt to know that you were leaving them behind. I remember driving in the car over from the coast the night we left and just bawling my eyes out. I was just like, just devastated. But I knew that was the choice we had to make.
And did you doubt that you'd done the right thing at times?
There was a lot of times we doubted it. When things sort of got tough and that, I would think, is God telling us that we've made the wrong decision and we need to go back to Gloryvale? There was always those nagging doubts, and that took probably years to completely get over that.
Tell me, could you have gone back?
No, I don't think so.
No. Would they have had you back? Sorry.
For a start, I think, for the first month or so, few months after we left, they probably would have welcomed us back with open arms. But then I started going in there undercover and talking to people and handing out literature and undercover and stuff, and very soon became public enemy number one, I guess. And so that sort of cut ties completely. I was probably a bit radical now looking back at it. I was pretty fired up, and one thing that had made me, I guess, very angry was, I told you about how I wrote the letter to everyone. So there was about 2 o'clock in the morning. At 4 o'clock, one of the ladies there got up to feed her baby, and she found the letter on her floor. So she got it and took it to one of the leaders on their floor of the hostel. And that leader went and woke up all the other leaders. They went around every bedroom and gathered up the letter so no one could read them. The dairy farming guys had gone early to, he was down the farm getting the cows in for milking, and they went down, found him, and he had a copy of the letter, and they took it off him so no one could read it. So that
did it put pressure on
right after it.
Did it put pressure on you and your wife's relationship as you went through the ups and downs of the emotions, or did you stay a tight unit throughout?
It did put pressure on it, but no, not undue pressure. I don't know. There was some pretty rough times.
And how about your children? How did they handle it through this?
I think our children probably handled it better than what we did. There was a couple of the younger ones that took it pretty rough losing their friends, but actually the older children, the teenagers, adapted very quickly and seemed to handle it quite well.
So what did you do for work?
So I was able to get a job reasonably quickly. We stayed at that couple's house for 6 weeks. So it was around mid-April. It was Easter weekend. We shifted out to a farm near Pleasant Point. We were given a job there on a dairy farm, and I ended up managing the dairy farm, and my 17-year-old and 15-year-old boy were staff on the farm.
Nice.
So yeah, we all lived in the house together and worked on the farm together.
How wonderful. And
so we had made the decision as a family before.
You just cut out, James, but keep going.
Am I back again?
Yeah, just tell us about you made the decision on the farm to...
Yeah, we made the decision before we left Gloryvale that we would, for the first year, we would pool our resources, our wages and everything, and save up enough money so we could go shear milking after 1 year.
Wow.
Which is what we did. And so after 1 year, we moved out to a farm on the east side of Tomoka, and we've been there for 7 years.
Wow. And you're loving it?
Yep, absolutely.
You're loving your church?
Yeah. Very, very, very much. Yeah, no, it's an amazing church. It's an amazing group of people. In a lot of ways, there's an, I don't know if some of the church people would like me saying this, but there's an element of such a close-knit family.
You just cut out, James. You said you weren't sure whether the church members would allow, like you saying this, but you said there's an element of...
An element that's similar to Gloryvale in that...
Oh, yes.
It's a very close-knit family environment and a very loving group of people.
So it's got the good.
Yep.
Tell me, did your kids go to school?
So when we first left, we were very afraid of schooling outside of Gloryvale, and my wife had done quite a lot of teaching at Gloryvale. She had been the headmaster's secretary for a number of years, and she had taught classes as well. And so she was very keen on homeschooling. We homeschooled for about 18 months. And then baby number 14 came along, and she was a very difficult baby. And so we decided to send the children to the Timaru Christian School. And they went there for about 3 years, and we're homeschooling again now, which is another story, how that came about.
We might have to save that for another day, James. Yeah. All the kids happy and well?
Absolutely. No, we've been very blessed. I think our family has done amazingly. Our oldest daughter owns her own business in Timaru and employs 3 staff. Another daughter's married in Timaru. One of our second oldest son is shear milking in the Waikato.
What an amazing thing.
On the farm.
Your children are going to have a completely different life because of that one night that you left.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And your brothers and sisters back in Gloryvale?
So since we left 8 years ago, there's, I don't know if I can count them, but I think Gloryvale since we've left.
You just cut out again, James. This is terrible, but I can't stop.
Yeah.
How many have left, did you say?
So four more of my siblings have left in the last few years.
Okay. Are you in touch with them?
Yeah, no, very much. And I'm actually, things have changed at Gloryvale a lot over the last few years, and I can contact brothers and sisters that are still in Gloryvale as well.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. Now, one of the things when you contacted me, there's so much I'm busting to talk to you about because you've had such an amazing life. But one of the things that God knows how you make of transgenderism and all the rest of it, and I feel like running running back to Gloryvale myself, given how mad the world has become.
Yep.
When I look at what's going on in my kids' school, I feel like running away back to Gloryvale. Tell me, COVID came along. What did you make of that?
Very quickly, I was just thinking that the mainstream narrative, the official narrative, was a bit crazy. I guess I very early on started looking up information from overseas and sort of, you know, seeing the age group of people that were dying and that, and thinking, okay, this is nuts, what's going on here?
And of course you understand the science and disease of herds, right? You understand cows getting sick and contagions. So you were well-placed, and also I guess you had been used to spotting bullshit.
I guess from being at Glory,
we had getting such a bad connection now. Try again. From being at Gloryvale, you learned to spot this stuff.
Yeah. Very quickly learned that we had to question everything. Everything we were taught, you know, everything we'd been taught in the past, everything we were hearing, we had to question it all. And so I guess that set us in a good place for when the pandemic came along.
Yeah. So you didn't buy it?
No.
I've got a picture of you that's popped up when you turned the video out, and it looks like you with, I'm assuming, is that four daughters?
Four daughters, yeah.
Well, they look amazingly happy and healthy, but it looks to me like you're at the protest at Parliament.
It does look that way, yeah. We were up there to join the river of filth, I guess.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, I guess as soon as the convoy came along, I was following that straight away and was very excited. And then following, probably mainly following Chantelle Baker, seeing what was going on at the protest.
Yes.
And I remember February the 10th, the day that they tried to push them out, I was watching a live stream from Stuff and also from Chantelle Baker. And the video I was seeing from Stuff wasn't lining up with what they were saying was happening.
No.
And I was like, okay, well, this is weird. They're not even making, I can see that what they're saying is not true. So why are they bothered having a live stream there? Because they're just making themselves look silly. We decided, right, we're going up. Another group from our church had just been up a few days before that as well. And they were just blown away by, and the same with us. It was just like, wow, this is amazing. I guess that the feeling of love and acceptance and that was probably heightened by what we had just been through, you know, not being able to talk to anyone and being divided.
Well, outside of my family events, going to that protest was the greatest experience of my life.
Yeah, I can totally understand you saying that.
And so you, in a funny way, the single source of truth, the tyrannical control over our lives that was exhibited.
Yeah.
The shutting down of any dissent, or as we now know, even big tech shutting down information from outside, we started to live like Gloryvale.
Exactly. It became very scary to us very quickly, the whole
single source of truth, narrative, and that sort of thing. Because, I mean, that was like what we had lived with all our lives, that we weren't allowed to question what we were told. All the news we received was censored. We were told what to think. We weren't allowed to have an opinion that differed from what we were told. And I guess that's why so many of us rebelled against that.
It's fascinating and ironic, isn't it, that the media, who have been hypercritical of Glorvale and I think abusive of it and people, and yet they partook of a cultish love of a government that was exercising a tyranny unprecedented in the Western world and presenting itself as a single source of truth, with the journalists not falling over laughing. The irony is rich, is it not?
Oh, very, very, yeah.
And so you've become a good listener of Reality Check Radio.
Yes, I became a good listener of another news outlet a little while ago, but got a bit disenchanted with it.
I think that's the platform, was it?
It sure was, yeah. Probably early on in my listening, when I first discovered it, one of the first interviews I heard was Paul Brennan's interview with Matt Shelton.
Oh, wasn't that stunning?
And I thought, wow, this is amazing. This is, you know, we're going to be hearing this sort of interview all the time. But yeah, it sort of quickly became apparent to me that that wasn't what was going to happen.
It's a funny thing, news, isn't it? Because I, to my great discredit, had followed SOS Doctors and Dr. Mel Shelton, but I'd always been a bit wary of it because I despise the media. I don't believe the media, but the endless propaganda that they run affects your mind. And so I had a negative view of Dr. Shelton. And when I heard him on that interview, he was so smart, so across it, so wonderful. And I thought, how dreadful is this? Because they had painted such a negative view of this man.
Yeah. Yeah, and you see that. We've seen a similar sort of thing all over again with the whole Posey Parker
incident.
Like, they've painted her as a anti-trans activist and a Nazi and white supremacist. They've never interviewed her to let people know what she actually says.
No.
And they didn't, you know, same with Dr. Matt Shelton and so many others, just didn't give them an opportunity to speak, shut them down. As you said earlier, talking about evil, I think that's extremely evil.
I think it's evil. I think it's evil in the biblical sense now. I'm becoming a believer. Because
keep going.
I am I looked at that and I thought, we've lost all our basic Christian values, and everything that's in the Bible is being overturned, like God created a man and a woman. That has to be turned on its head, you know. And the other thing that troubles me about modern life is the lack of anything sacred.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I feel that time that we have lived through has forced for me a big rethink, and like a lot of people. And I'm coming to... It's been very hard for me. It's probably, nothing like what you've been through, but in a similar way, seeing through the disappointment of our parliament, you know, the disappointment in our news media, the disappointment in experts, the disappointment government and community leaders who just parroted the lockdown story and the jab. I'm taking it that you and your wife and your kids aren't jabbed.
No. One of our oldest sons is. He made that decision himself, yeah. But the rest of us aren't. And yeah. Very glad that we're not.
Yeah. Well, it looks, I mean, everything that Matt Sheldon said and got lost his practicing certificate for has turned out to be true.
Yeah.
And just like, I guess, you know, you've found out what you were brought up with wasn't true. So much of it wasn't true. So much of it was good. But there was a tyrannical you were isolated and had this tyrannical control over you. James, what do you see for the future for yourself, but more particularly for New Zealand?
You cut out a bit there. I think
what do you see for in the future for yourself and for New Zealand?
I guess for me, being a Christian, my faith is in the fact that God is in control and nothing can happen outside of his control. And so that gives me a lot of security and peace and calm. But I find it terrifying what's happening to the country. On the other hand, it's just insanity as far as I'm concerned. And it seems like the country is intent on destroying itself.
Yes, and of course, we're exploring on the radio, Reality Check Radio, we've been exploring this wokery. And of course, none of the political parties are providing us with hope that the madness will end.
Yeah, no, absolutely. At Gloryvale, we just about always voted National because we saw them, I guess, as the conservative party and the party that was pro-farming. But I certainly don't see it that way anymore. No. I don't see them as being any different to Labor, really.
Well, I feel the same way, I'm sorry to say, about my old party, the ACT Party. I'm bitterly disappointed. Because I was bitterly disappointed that they supported the mandates and they lost me and the support of the lockdowns, this tyranny. And if they came out and David Seymour issued a 3,000 word apology, he might win me back. But you can't just come back from that. That was so fundamental. To me. And so I tell everyone I'm a single issue voter. I'll vote for the party that promises to launch a parliamentary or proper inquiry into these poor people that have been vaccine injured because they have been appallingly treated. James, I can't thank you enough for coming on our show. You have shared your life and your wife's life and your children's life with us and opened yourself up to us, the Reality Check Radio and the listeners. It's been an amazing experience for us to learn about Gloryvale and to learn about your life. I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of everyone when I say that we admire you and your wife's and your children's bravery and fortitude and making your way and your success. We admire those wonderful Christians that looked after you and helped you and your family. That is truly a wonderful, touching, heartwarming experience. And I'm sure I speak on behalf of everyone when I wish you and your wife and your children every success.
Thank you.
And you will be in our prayers for all of us.
Thank you.
Because you're wonderful. Thank you so much, James. You've been listening to Reality Check Radio. I'm Rodney Hyde with Real Talk. I feel moved and different for having listened to James's story of him and his family. And you realize that all around us, there are amazing people that we brush against every day. And we can learn of their stories and learn so much and become better people for seeing what they have done. And I can't imagine leaving that community with 12 and a half kids, or was it 13 and a half? No, 12 and a half kids with nothing but the clothes on your back and a nephew and a church group. And then for that church group to say, you and your 12 rowdy kids can live in our house and we'll camp here in our tent. It's a wonderful story. You with Reality Check Radio. And I'm Rodney Hyde, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. That was a remarkable man, James Harrison. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.